Today, we speak to a man with a vision of how that most tweedy of titles, The Times Literary Supplement, fits into a 21st century newsstand, plus a distinctly Iberian lifestyle publication that made the leap from digital to print, and an award-winning magazine taking a closer look at mental health. All that ahead of us on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Henry Rhys-Sheridan, standing in this week for Tom Edwards. The Times Literary Supplement has a long history, first appearing in 1902 as a supplement to The Times of London, before becoming its own thing in 1914. It's never had trouble attracting contributions from the literary A-list, but its current editor, Stig Abel, thinks the weekly can be more than just a talking shop for the intelligentsia and quench a widespread thirst for serious, long-form writing amidst the clickbait and listicles that make up much of what passes for journalism on the internet. Here's Stig speaking to me a little earlier.
Well, it's got a very misleading title because it's the Times Literary Supplement and it's no longer connected to the Times. It's more than literary and it's not a supplement. It was created out of the Times newspaper 115 years ago and then about 15 years later started producing itself as a standalone magazine. It's basically a magazine of culture and ideas which is designed to cover as broad a range as possible from literature, obviously, but also to politics and philosophy, anthropology, to zoology. So it's supposed to be a place where you read really good writing about big ideas and big books, covering a broader range as possible.
And tell me a little bit about your personal history with the publication and how you came to edit it.
When I left university, one of the things the TLS was very good at, which I hope we still are, is that we allowed people, just new writers, to come along. So I wrote to the fiction editor and said I'd like to review fiction books. And so for 10 years, I used to write book reviews for the TLS and other papers. And meanwhile, I had various other strands to a career. I ended up running the Press Complaints Commission, so I wasn't a journalist, but I sort of dealt with complaints against journalists. I then did some crisis management of all things, and then I became the managing editor of The Sun newspaper when they were going through a traumatic period, and did that for a couple of years and then wanted to move on, and then this job became available. So at one level it sounds strange, you used to work at a tabloid and now you're editing the Times Literary Supplement, but on the other, I'd written for it back from when I was 21 and had always had a great deal of affection for it. So it was kind of my first job in journalism back in 2001, and now it's my current job again.
Since taking on the editorship, you've been very successful in increasing the circulation of the TLS, both digital visitors to its website, but also its print circulation as well. Talk me through how you went about doing this from your first day as editor, and also how you thought about that challenge coming from The Sun.
The main reason almost is I think there's a kind of golden age of interest in intelligent journalism in breadth and range. I think, bearing in mind that we're so, and this is true of your services as well, actually, that we live in a world where we're bombarded by bleeps and clicks and 30-second videos and what's called fake news, and everything is too fast and it's overwhelming sometimes, and quality slips. It's a very clickbaity culture that has saturated everything. And I think a counterculture is growing up in the same way that fast food's invention in the 80s led to a sort of slow food movement, you know, organic food and farmers markets. I think exactly the same thing is happening in culture. People crave moments of repose, they crave expertise, contrary to what Michael Gove may have said a couple of years ago. They crave the ability to sort of lean back and read something thoughtful and engaging and challenging. I think we're living in an age of autodidacticism, a bit like the Victorian times, where people want to learn more. And so in that sense, the TLS is a kind of perfect vehicle for the moment. It's a time when we can think, I want to know about philosophy, or I want to know about 17th century Dutch painting, not because there's any intrinsic use to it, but because I value information and expertise and beautiful writing. So when I came in, I wrote a sort of two-page thing of what I'd want to do with it, but largely it was just to get it out there a little bit more, to expand what we're doing, to have a broad range, an even broader range of material. But I really fundamentally believe this, that amid all the kind of facility and naffness and crapness of our collective culture. There is a mirror image of that respects kind of beauty and diligence and thoughtfulness. And so my aim from the beginning was to say, well, let's celebrate that. The TLS actually, as it happens, has been doing it for 115 years. It's a very good vehicle for that. And so I had a very clear view really from the beginning that we had to do what we did already well, carry on doing that, expand further, and then make our reach a little bit more felt. So have a podcast, have a newsletter, have a social media presence, be in more shops so people can see more of us, and try and capitalize on this zeitgeisty moment that, although there's lots of downsides to it, the countercultural upside is that people like information and expertise and beauty perhaps more than ever, and I wanted to sort of pay respect to that.
When you pick up any literary review, really, it can feel quite kind of arcane. It would be great if you could demystify kind of the anatomy of the TLS for us. So what are its sections, and how do you think about putting it together?
Well, I try and think about it. Each issue often has a broad theme. So it might be anthropology or politics. And that doesn't mean the whole issue is dedicated to it, that there is a connection between three or four of the pieces. I mean, really what I try and aim to do is have pieces that, although they might cover a wide range of subjects, they have some relevance to one another. They'll be written by people who are experts in their field. They'll often be book reviews, but not uniformly now with the TLS. So there might be an extract from a novel or a piece of work in progress from someone who's writing a book. So the first half will be built around that premise. In the middle, there'll be a arts pages, fiction pages, so the latest books, the latest cultural events reviewed, and then it will carry on into the second half. When I inherited the paper, it had a readership that was 80-20 male-female, and it largely had a writership that was 80-20 male-female. And one of the things I've tried to do is to get that to 50-50. So these things can feel, I think, a little bit inaccessible, because you think, well, is this for me? Largely because it was often written by people of a very certain type, and we still have great, obviously we still have lots of men writing for us, but I was very much keen to open up to a wider range of people writing for it as possible, in order to convince people who are readers to have a go as well. So really it shouldn't seem inaccessible. It should just simply be people who are interested in ideas on a wide range of subjects should find something of interest in the paper. So I'm actually looking at the paper that came out this week. The front page is an emoji, and it's about writing in the internet age, and it's a review of a style guide to BuzzFeed as part of a larger essay that talks about internet writing. Has the internet corrupted our way of communicating? And that's connected to a different piece, which is about the history of writing things down. The history of paper, which sounds kind of boring, but actually is really important. When did knowledge stop being transmitted orally and then became written down? And then it moves into other areas like history, Russian history, the history of networks, anthropology, just looking at also their music, so a music memoir. And so it's really as broad a range as possible, that idea of a kind of attic of stuff where you can find bits of interest all over. And I don't want people ever to feel that's inaccessible. I really want it to be the opposite. They should pick up the paper every week and think, oh, is there something that grabs my attention? And you know, I always say to people here, we should always feel there's something we're proud of every week. Oh, you should read that piece. We had a great piece last week by Marcel Theroux, who told the story of a guy who faked a gospel of Jesus that pretended he went to India in his adolescent period. And it was this big New York Times reported it. It was believed for a while, but this amazing story about a Jewish guy who faked it in order to try and make the Jewish religion look more appealing to anti-Semites in Russia. It's a fascinating story. I'd never heard of it, and it was a great thing to do. And I think that's what I really want the paper to be, just full to bursting, full of stuff that you might not have thought about before, but you can get into.
One of the things that interests me about your background at The Sun, aside from the kind of contrast in tone between the TLS and The Sun, is that The Sun is still a newspaper which is very much a newspaper. It's the highest physical circulation of all the dailies in Britain. I think that's still true.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in hearing, are there any editorial principles that you can apply equally to The Sun and the TLS as an editor?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and I was managing editor of The Sun, so my job wasn't to be the editor. I was often doing the dealing with complaints, dealing with personnel issues, dealing with budgets and things like that, as well as trying to sort of support the staff. So it's a slightly different role, really. But the editorial principles, I think, are broadly the same. So this notion of what are we going to be remembered for today is a very critical part of good tabloid journalism. It might be a headline, it might be a picture, it might be a story. And I think for a weekly magazine, it's exactly the same thing. What's the one thing you could tell someone that you did that week that you should be proud of, that sense of urgency? And there's things like clarity. So the TLS never used to have, this is quite a technical sort of newspapery thing, it never had subdecks, that little subtitle underneath every headline. So you'd end up with a headline that might say something like Moons and Mountains, and then you'd have no idea what that was about. And why would you read an article headline Moons and Mountains without knowing really what you're getting yourself into? So principles like signposting, linking stories, subdecks, even as sort of wonkish as that, that translates very much directly from a newspaper, a daily newspaper like The Sun, into a weekly magazine like the TLS. The principle of all journalism, I think, is trying to convey a story clearly and making people interested in that story at the beginning to get them invited and involved. And that principle is actually really critical at the TLS, I think.
And looking into the future, what are your ambitions for the TLS, in particular the print edition of the TLS, and where that's going to fit in to the broader TLS ecosystem?
The circulation last week was the highest it's been since before 1980. The highest ever circulation was in 1950. So I want to get to that. I think the way the print paper should work, and this is true of all sort of high-end magazines, is people who subscribe to a magazine like the TLS should get the print one. I mean, you can just have a digital only and that works and it's lovely, but I think the perfect way of experiencing this is to get something beautifully produced, which is a real-world artifact like a magazine, together with an access to our 115-year archive, an access to a website, an app, and all of that. So there's a full experience of it. So you can, you know, you can look at a bit on your phone or listen to a podcast, and there's that all sensory experience you get. But that's probably still centered on the lovely feeling of sitting down, as you do with a book, with a magazine, and reading a 5,000 word article. I think probably bits of paper is still the best technology in the world for reading something that's 5,000 words long or more. So my aim is to try and keep growing and expanding so more people hopefully can find it and then get into it.
Stig Abel there, editor of the Times Literary Supplement. Find out more about the publication at the-tls.co.uk. Observador started as a digital platform showing off the best of Portuguese craft and lifestyle products. But after a while, the information superhighway began to feel a bit pokey, and it decided to branch out into print. To find out more, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Observador's founder, João Miguel Tavares.
We are trying to develop the brand in a way that we can go to other places and not only online. And so I've been working with them to accomplish that.
And João, it's fantastic because, you know, there's a lot of print publications that, you know, they start investing heavily on digital. But in your case, it was actually the opposite. You know, you had a digital project since 2014, and then you guys decided, well, maybe we should make it a beautiful magazine. And I have to say, it is indeed. I have issue number one in front of me. And I have to say, it feels very glossy. It feels, you know, there's about 148 pages. And one thing that impressed me is how proud of you guys to say you're 100% Portuguese, you know, showing the Portuguese craft. Was that one of your ideas?
The idea of going to print, if a digital project is going to print, the main idea would be to have some kind of a Observador premium. So it's the best content that the Observador put available online. And so, of course, it's really great for an editor to go to a place where you have so many good content and you can pick it one by one. So then to build a good magazine, you know, like a magazine that really works. It's the best of the lifestyle of Observador, but of course we also try to put some new content in there. Well, lots of people in Observador love print, okay? And I'm one of them. So we really wanted to do a different magazine and not only just one more lifestyle magazine like you have so many in Portugal. We wanted really to have a premium magazine. And you know, Monocle was a source of inspiration. And so we wanted that kind of magazine, you know, a premium magazine that could give to the Portuguese audience a product with more quality that they are accustomed to and that they are used to. Lots of Portuguese, they of course buy foreign magazines because we have lots of foreign magazines in our bookshops. I don't know why people don't produce them. And so I think we had here a beautiful opportunity to do that. Okay, so we had a huge amount of content because it's content that has been produced 1 year or 2 years ago. And of course, we picked the best stories and then sometimes we just phone people, of course. We wanted the information and the information to be as new as possible. And so we did that kind of work, but it's really nice to work in that way. You don't need to go to journalists and try to arrange with them to do some kind of subjects. And of course, they have to go there to find the stories. But sometimes the stories come and they are not as good as you have planned in the beginning. When we start doing a magazine like this, you have content that you know it works from the beginning of the magazine. So you can invest in design and you can invest in photography and you can invest in illustration so that when the magazine comes to the bookshops and it goes to the public, you really can feel that's a best of and a premium magazine in terms of design and the photography and content.
And finally, João, for those who haven't seen the magazine, so what are the main content of it? Is it mainly kind of celebrating, Portuguese makers, someone doing, a nice fashion clothing or a nice furniture or nice wine?
Well, since we had so many content, to choose from, our main idea was to do it 100% Portuguese. But we didn't want to do it 100 Portuguese like with sardines and with gold Barcelos, that stuff that it seems like for tourists, We wanted to try to find a modern Portugal because that Portugal exists nowadays. To do a beautiful lifestyle magazine that could be found anywhere in all the good places of Europe. Because I think in Portugal we still have to try to get to that level of sophistication, okay? Sometimes it doesn't exist. Nowadays we have a very popular and a very in a country that, of course, it's full of tourists and everybody's talking about it. We have a beautiful country. Lisbon, it's a beautiful city. Porto, it's a beautiful city, of course. But in terms of printing design and printing magazines, I think we still have to make an effort to get there. And that was our main objective, okay? So it was to find a new Portugal, a sophisticated Portugal. And so the content was chosen in that way. We wanted to be 100% Portuguese, but also 100% cool and 100% sophisticated.
That was João Miguel Tavares, founder of Observador magazine. Finally on today's show, awareness of mental health issues has improved dramatically in recent decades. It's a shift that's been reflected by more sensitive and accurate media coverage. Still, as our next guest noticed, most of the coverage tends towards treating extreme cases with medicalised language. ANXI is a magazine that takes a different approach to tackling mental health, focusing on personal stories artfully told. The first issue hit newsstands in May of last year following a successful Kickstarter fundraiser and was met with immediate praise, scooping a couple of gongs at the annual Stack Awards at the end of the year. It's the brainchild of Indira Rojas. I caught up with her earlier. Indira, thanks for joining me. Let's begin at the beginning. Where did you get the idea for a print magazine about mental health?
I have a background in graphic design, so I've always wanted to do a magazine. Any graphic designer, very much in love with print. I never had quite the right idea of what the magazine could be until I started going to therapy and, working on my own, personal growth and going through my personal history and realizing that there's a lot of stories of really challenging things that people face that we don't really talk about and that we keep to ourselves because we might be ashamed of them or don't think people will understand us. And I just had this idea, what would happen if we could create a print magazine where, people could tell those very personal stories in a way that felt authentic and unique and really touched upon those vulnerable aspects that we sometimes are afraid to talk about.
So each issue of ANCSI is themed according to a different aspect of mental health. Could you tell me what themes you've explored and why you chose those themes?
The themes right now have been somewhat autobiographical. There are things that I've been curious about that connect to my own therapy experience and things that I feel like a lot of people who are going through that experience also can connect with. So, for example, the first issue with anger. Anger is, you know, one of those most complex emotions. People can feel a lot of shame about feeling angry. But, you know, we also need to feel angry to be able to process very difficult experiences. So I felt like I wanted to start the series of the magazine with an emotion that we can judge as being either good or bad or you know, healthy or unhealthy, and trying to have that complex conversation about what does it mean to be, you know, to be angry. The next issue, the ones that's current now, is the workaholism issue. We wanted to explore, you know, what does it mean to cope with work and cope with the mental health challenges that come through work, especially if you're someone who is trying to use work as a distraction or use work as a way to distance yourself for certain things you might not want to deal with at the moment. Like, how does that work play a role in either easing our, you know, experience in life or complicating it by allowing us to put certain things at bay? So, you know, workaholism is one of the issues I deal with personally. And every time I talk to my friends and, you know, colleagues, and we talk about the role of work in our lives, I noticed that it was something that people were really eager to discuss because they also, you know, work is a really big aspect of their lives. And we all have this, you know, shared curiosity around what are the healthy boundaries around work and when are we using work as a way to cope and as a way to not deal with certain things.
I'm interested in understanding where you found the contributors to ANCSI. Are they mainly established writers, or did you look elsewhere to find people to write for the magazine?
So we try to do a combination because we do want ANCSI to be a place for emerging voices. So we do a combination of open submissions where people come to us and they submit through our submittable and pitches their ideas. And from there, we curate the stories that are most aligned with our theme. And those might be writers who are not that well established or might be new to the craft. And then we also think about voices that we want to include in the magazine that are from writers that we know and work that we are aware of that connects with what we want to say about the issue. So it's a combination of both emerging and established writers. Our editor-in-chief, Bobby Johnson, he works with, you know, our other editors to reach out to our networks, kind of request for them to pitch to our magazine and include their voices in the topics that we're covering.
And why did you decide to put ANCSI in the form of a print magazine in particular? I'm also interested in the specific challenges of illustrating abstract mental health issues in a very visual medium.
For me, I felt like we wanted the content of the magazine to feel evergreen. And, you know, as someone who has worked in publishing online, one of the things that you see with publishing specifically online is you receive this content, you might consume it really quickly because you might be on your phone or on your work computer or whatever. I mean, then that content kind of disappears. You might bookmark it, you might email it to yourself, but it's really not something that you might bump into in your house the way you would do a magazine or something that you can grab and revisit in a way that, you know, slows down your day, allows you to reflect and really take in the content. So the print for us was a way to offer a counter format to the online format so that people could really sit down with our stories and reflect on them and treat it the way they might treat it, like a physical book, for example. We really wanted, you know, our audience to have something they could grab onto physically and have that, you know, reading experience in a way that is not only more traditional, but also allows them to slow down. And then in terms of creating the visual aesthetic for the magazine and trying to represent these abstract concepts, as a designer, I have a good understanding of the power of design. And that's sort of what I was envisioning when thinking about ANCSI, like how can you infuse the power of design to create an alternative narrative of what we expect mental health conversations to be about and what we expect mental health publishing and editorial to look like. And for me, when I think of myself as a designer and an artist, or I think about other artists, this whole inner world that we're trying to express through our work, and that inner world is reflective to the inner challenges that we might be facing. And I really wanted that aspect of art and design to be part of the aesthetic of the magazine, to create a more complete picture of what it's like to not only talk about these issues, but represent these issues in a way that is aligned to, you know, what's really going on in our lives.
Anxiety's already received plenty of recognition within the magazine world. It got 2 different awards at the Stack Awards that I attended towards the end of last year, launch of the year, and also Subscriber's Choice, which you've got to be pleased with, considering that the subject matter of the magazine is something that affects everyone. What's your ambition for Anxiety in the future? Have you got an idea of themes that you'd like to explore?
We're really excited about seeing how far we can take ANXI, and if we can start, you know, growing beyond print into events. We were thinking about crazy ideas like a conference or like a music concert, or, you know, trying to create experiences just like the experience we're trying to create with the print magazine, but create that experience in, you know, in like 101 environments. In terms of the issues, I've been thinking a lot about issue 3, and we're going to be tackling the subject of boundaries. Boundaries is, you know, another very intriguing concept for me, because I feel like it represents many things that we're discussing today, whether it's the conversation happening here in the US around, you know, sexual assault, or it's the conversation we're having around identity, the conversation we're having about place and belonging. And we want to cover that topic. Again, trying to do the same thing we did with anger, where we're covering from the point of view of, you know, here are some difficult aspects about boundaries, and here are some like relieving or positive aspects about boundaries. Like, I also see us being able to talk about self-care through the lens of boundaries and things like this.
Indira, thank you so much for joining us. When can we get hold of issue 3?
We're tentatively launching it. We like to launch it for Mental Health Week around the first week of May. And that's sort of our aim. And then from there, it will take a few weeks for it to arrive to other parts of the world, since, you know, shipping takes time and things like this. But around May is our launch date.
Indira Rojas there, speaking to me a little earlier. Find out more about ANXI at anxiemag.com. That's it for this week's show. The show was produced by me and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Cassie Galpin and George McDonough were the editors. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to write to Fernando at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. Of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or on iTunes. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.